Does any of you need copies of there again that want them? They aren't expensive and they are in the bookstore. I mean, if you want any, we have about 20 left. Because I ordered 50, I didn't want to be broke. We don't worry, they'll be sold anyway. Because I use this for term illustration and move that one down to see what my text was. One more chair over there if any of you are comfortable on the floor. You want to sit over there, Al? Well, this fireplace of the tower says I will not warm a cold heart, and I'll go ahead and sleep.
How it worked on this too.
Yeah. So, I know what we do without them around here. We eat so fast because we're running out of cigars. That's why he's leaving. So if any of you are eating, why not some cigars? Wonderful. Keep them here longer.
Now, we have a number of books that we're going to look at the next few days. Peer Gynt is the first one, and then Brand, then Camus, The Stranger, and then Moby Dick. Before we start, though, I must not only confess, but also insist that there are some presuppositions, at least a presupposition, with regard to Peer Gynt and all the rest of them. I don't know whether you people care about presuppositions, but you ought to, for a number of very obvious reasons. You'll agree they're obvious as soon as they're mentioned. One is that presuppositions are enormously significant. That is, they have consequences. And if presuppositions seem to be far back or far down, far away, one doesn't escape the consequences of presuppositions. Now, presupposition is simply what you start with when there ain't no more. It's like Heidi, remember? Correct me if I forget this little bit of reading years ago, but Heidi was up in the mountains there in Switzerland with Peter, and she was asking, where does this little pool come from? Well, that comes from that creek. Don't you see it? Well, where does that little creek come from? Well, that comes from a little basin up there. Well, where does that come from? Well, that comes from another little stream that comes down. Well, where does that come from? Well, that comes from the beginning. He said, well, where's the beginning of the beginning? Well, that's what presuppositions are like. They're sort of the beginning of the beginning. He was getting disgusted with it, you know. He kept pushing them back. But that's the way presuppositions are. They're way back. And even though they are way back, they have serious consequences. You may remember do you know those little Brother Sebastian things? Do they run them anymore? You've seen them, haven't you? You remember that one? He's putting on this, I suppose a cassock. He's this big, long robe with about 490 buttons. And they're all buttoned up, and then it shows him looking, kind of pulling it out here and looking at the last one, and there's one button left over. And then you look down below, and you see one buttonhole left over. Well, that's the point. If you start that way, you end up crooked. I do it with this sweater even. I have to kind of look down and count a little bit, because I end up with too many buttons or too many buttonholes. And the point is, if you are consistent, your presuppositions are of enormous importance, you see, because your presupposition is what you're standing on. I don't see him. He was sitting next to me at dinner. A little boy came along and asked him about his leg. And he said, well, I scratched it up. It's all right, Bob.
That's right. He was telling this little boy, you stay out of that, call it the engineering building up there?
Where?
Or something, he said, and certainly stay out of the upper levels there. I fell there. And the boy said, yeah, I heard about that. How's your leg? Scratched up. Well, the point is, his presupposition was that there was a floor for him to walk on up there. And it was just lucky somehow that he recovered, you see. I mean, there happened to be some insulation stretched over there, but there's nothing underneath. I mean, he was presupposing, you see, that there was a wooden, good wooden ceiling, you know, which constituted a floor for him. No, presuppositions have a lot of consequences. And if you don't recognize presuppositions, that has a lot of consequences. Or if you misunderstand your own and other people's presuppositions. It's very important. Now, where's Dr. Collins? Now, you don't have to accept what I'm going to attribute to you here. But he was operating with presuppositions the other night, you see. He didn't tell you what they were. We can't always go around telling what our presuppositions are. You know, you're going to start a conversation. You can't very well say, now my presuppositions are A, B, C, what are yours? But they're still going to affect the conversation very much. And I'm just assuming that Dr. Collins, in talking to us, presupposed, for example, a world of rational discourse. Otherwise he'd be a goose, wouldn't he? Standing up there making not voices but noises, as Busted would say. You see, just plain noises. He presupposes a world of rational discourse, that there are sounds that have meaning and that these sounds have meaning to people who have ears and so on. Now, he presupposed that in the very talk that he gave, for instance, on glaciers. He was presupposing the principle of uniformity. That is, that somehow glaciers are glaciers, you see. And not every glacier is totally different. But there is a category that you can call glaciers, and therefore, did you notice, he talked about glaciers in this area which he had never seen. That's fantastic for an observational scientist, isn't it? To talk about glaciers here, which he never saw. So, furthermore, nobody else saw any here. There are some presuppositions with regard to uniformity, so that he can talk about glaciers where there aren't any now, and he can ignore this matter of time, that it's both a matter of geography and time in this principle of uniformity. That is, he presupposed something about us, a world of discourse. Second, he presupposed something about things. Otherwise, he couldn't have talked as he talked to us. And you presupposed it, you see. Therefore, you understood him, at least in part. Not only are presuppositions such that they have consequences, not only are they inescapable, but it's of extreme importance, therefore, to be aware of presuppositions. Now, this young man, this ex-criminal...
Presuppose I could do that.
Well, he presupposed that he could, and you notice the tenderness with which he did it? He approached it with certain presuppositions, you see, about this and this, this means this, and this means this, and therefore you've been well brought up. Well, I took a little time on that because I'm making a presupposition in approaching these works, and it's a very serious presupposition.
It may not sound like a serious one, so I'll proceed to point out that it's a very serious presupposition, even though everybody here might agree with the presupposition. And it is simply this. I'm presupposing that art has meaning. That art has meaning. Now you say, well, of course, any fool knows that. Yeah, that's right, some will say, but there are a lot of wise people who don't agree to that. I've told this before, I think, here, about an incident happened at Carleton. There was a symposium. Carleton College is a kind of a junior college in North Carolina. You have to have education at all levels nowadays, they say. Even in the same town. It was a symposium under the title of The Contemporary Image of Man and the Arts. It was kind of a left-handed approach of the religion department, you see. That's really what they're... So they had Joe Sittler there. It started out with a panel. Three Carleton professors, and then Joe Sittler fourth. The first one was a fellow named Scott Lucas, professor of English and something of a poet. So he was going to say something about the image of man in poetry. He never got around to it for the simple reason he said, I don't understand that title. I don't understand the possibility of that title. Because poetry doesn't have images of man. Poetry doesn't tell things about things. That isn't the function of poetry. He said, I don't even agree with a middle point, such as presented by Denis de Rougemont, who maintained that poetry is a trap for contemplation. Said poetry isn't for anything. Poetry is poetry, that's all. And the, of course, some of you might have brought to mind this thing by Archibald MacLeish, which he presented, this old one, that a poem is not to mean, but it is to be. A poem just is itself, that's all. It isn't supposed to mean something else. Isn't supposed to bring to mind something else. You stay within the poem. So there's a fascination of the poetic images. There's the explosiveness and the subtlety of the magic of words. They said poetry is made of words, not of ideas. Not of images of something, or poetic images, but they're images in themselves. Then the painter, Mr. Jacobson, came and said, well, I agree entirely with Scott Lucas. He said, I have a little harder time, at least I would with those of you who know me, and know that I have painted some landscapes, Cannon River Valley and Castle Rock and certain places. But he said, I've repented of all that. Painting isn't supposed to be of objects. Painting has its life in the patterning of space and color. This is what painting is. It's the kind of architecture of space and color. I don't know what he would have said, but theoretically he should have said something very complimentary, I suppose, of two paintings. How many have been at the exposition? How many belong in the subgroup B?
Red Holden Village, 18.
All right. Then I'll tell you about one of the things that riled the taxpayers about the American exhibit. There are a lot of things you've read about. Oh, you have, all right. You remember up on the, apart from the escalators and all that trouble, up on the second level are all kinds of things, including two paintings by, I can't remember by whom, but they're about four and a half, 5 feet wide each, and about 25 feet high. One is a clear, sheer canvas of cerise, sort of cherry color, you know. The other, right next to it, is a similar panel of flaming pink. That's a totality, except for this at the bottom, painted by so-and-so, such-and-such a date, with Sherwin Williams Sure Glow acrylic paint. Now, if poetry is simply made of words, well, paintings are made of paint. And he did it, you see, with that little blurb at the bottom of one of them. Well, these were painted for somebody. I think they actually were commissioned. So maybe the taxpayer doesn't even have to pay for those. They're borrowed. They're masterpieces on loan to an indigent government. Then the Miss Horsley, a musician, pianist, said, "Well, I'm in perfect agreement with all of you men. I perhaps have an easier task of pointing out why." She said, "Music. Music doesn't mean something. If you want to talk about the music of meaning in any sense," she maintained, "you can talk about it only in terms of the logic of the music. That is the patterns of pitch, intensity, and time. But that constitutes music. There's an enormous variety, but it doesn't mean something. It just is what it is, that's all. You may like it, you may not like it, but don't, please don't ask, what does it mean?" And then she went off on a little vituperative footnote about these fellows who write these things for the folders when you go to symphony concerts, you know, and explain and so on. She said, they shouldn't do a thing. They can have all the advertising that they want. 50 pages of advertising, cars and fur coats and all this, and that you could have one page, half a page, with regard to the music. Simply 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, intermission, 6, 7, 8. And that's all, with the titles. And better if the titles are only numbers. In fact, she says, you don't really need titles. In fact, you don't, for people who can count, you don't even need 1, 2, 3, 4. So she said, take that one page too, and sell it for ads, because music doesn't mean anything. Well, poor Joe Sittler, you know, I won't go further. You can, those of you who know him, know he did something very brilliant and so on. I remember one thing he did say, what do you mean? He tried to work it around to this religious tack that was intended. So he went at Miss Horsley saying, what about religious music? So there isn't such thing as religious music. There's music that religious people use. There's music that has come into the church and may be used repeatedly. And Joe said, you mean that this music of the liturgy doesn't mean anything? Said, if it means anything, it's just to lubricate the priest from one place to another. And said, well, that if you call that meaning, then that's all right. She said, that's just using it. That's just exploiting it. But it isn't taking any meaning out of the music. Well, I mention this because even though what we're really doing here, in a sense, is looking at philosophy in art, or in literature, there is a philosophy of art that is presupposed. And what I've been mentioning now is a view which if I held and if everybody else held it here, well, we could discuss this philosophy of art, but we wouldn't read any of these books. But I want to point out that this view of art is a strong, at least strongly held and widely held philosophy of art in our time, particularly by practitioners of the arts. These three that I mentioned were all called practitioners, you see. Do people want to say anything about McLuhan? Don't you know that McLuhan is God's gift to North America? Yes? Well, yeah? Would you want to give a speech on him?
I don't know too much about him, just that he seems to have a hand in every major newspaper.
Well, he has a slogan. It isn't his own. He stole it. But he, pardon?
The medium is the message.
That's right. The medium is the message. The medium is the message. That is, the medium doesn't contain a message. The medium isn't the vehicle for something, but it is that. Now, I'm not claiming that he's actually formulating this as this philosophy of art, but it seems to say the same thing. That is, that there's no distinction between form and content. You can't talk about the form of something and the content of something. If the work of art means anything at all, if it does, it certainly can't be separated from the work. The work is something. It isn't about something. Therefore, art is not an expression. It's not an expression of something. It just is something. It occurred to me today as I was thinking about this against the background of the Bowman's presentation yesterday. In a way, this is a kind of transubstantiation theory of art, isn't it? You know? He was pointing out this matter of the elements in the sacrament. Transubstantiation, and then another view, Lutheran view, it's a vehicle for something. The point is, the thing is what it is. And this is why, if you've ever seen, if you've been in a cathedral or Roman Catholic church, I know in St. Patrick's in New York, the young fellow goes along as the bread is administered, you see, lest any piece drop. I mean, that's very significant. I mean, it is something. It doesn't just mean something. It doesn't symbolize something. It is something. So it just occurred to me, in a way, this is a kind of transubstantiation view of art. It's not to be touched by laymen, actually. You're not to touch art with the simian fingers of analysis and coming with your questions. What is that? What does it mean? This is a kind of aesthetic sacrilege. The artwork is an object of contemplation in and for itself. And therefore, it's important symbolically that paintings have frames around them. You're supposed to stay within that, you see. You're not supposed to go outside it and ask about it. Now, this view of art is a kind of declaration of independence. I thought I'd bring that in connection with independence of Canada, in a sense, and 4th of July. All these immigrants want to be free from the motherland, you know. And what is this a declaration of independence from? It's a declaration of independence from art, or of art, from pedagogy. Art is not to teach. Lucretius, in his De Rerum Naturae, is actually presenting the philosophy of Epicurus and Democritus. And he says, I have put it in poetic form just as the mother rims the medicine spoon with honey, so that it is more palatable. Well, now, this view that I've been talking about is a denial of that idea, you see. that art is for pedagogical purposes, and you do it up in a kind of nice way, you see, in order to teach. It's a declaration of independence from all kinds of exhortation. That is, any kind of preaching or propaganda. I mean, the idea of getting something across and getting people to accept it, and using art, that it can't be used. And if it could, it shouldn't be used, according to this view. It's also a declaration of independence from art is deception, as Freud presents art. He maintains that art is really the expression of the artist. So all art is autobiographical. And he does then is to add something to his private story, which he says gives a foretaste of pleasure to the reader, who then will be willing to go on and listen to your story, because nobody likes to listen to other people's autobiography, you know. Do you ever try to tell anybody about your operation? The dullest thing, you know, they don't care, but you put it in artistic form, Freud says, and people will listen to your troubles. Well, this view of art is a declaration of independence from that. It's a declaration of independence of the decorative theory of art, that art is to pretty up things, you know, whether it's embroidering sweaters or neck pieces and all this kind of thing. Well, there are many other forms of that from which this is a declaration of independence. We could say that in philosophy of art there are really two poles, and this is one of the poles. Now let's give it a name. Clive Bell, a British philosopher of art, defines art as significant form. That is, this is a formalist view of art that we've been talking about. Art is form. That's what it is. Or rather, we should say, art is essentially the how. And there isn't any what. At least there isn't any analyzable what. There isn't any separable what, you see. Art isn't about anything. The artistic is constituted by how this thing is made of words, of stone, of paint, of sound, and that's the end of it. Keats gave expression to this when he said that beauty is truth, truth beauty. That's all we know and that's all we need to know. You see. Truth, we usually think of being about something. You say something true about something, or you tell a lie about somebody. It's about something. But here you get the idea of the identity of art and truth, the inseparability. There isn't any what. At the other end of the spectrum in philosophy of art is really art is representation. That is, the task of the artist is to give again something. Does anybody here ever had a portrait painted of himself? Or have you seen a portrait being painted of somebody else? Well, you know what question comes up, or what the kind of comment that comes. That doesn't look like her at all. That doesn't look like her at all. This is a representation, a representational philosophy of art, that the artistic work is to take something and present it again in a certain form, a memorable form, but it's a presentation of something, whether it's a poem or a painting. It's a little harder to hold this view of art with regard to architecture and music, unless music is supposed to, you know, hunt in the Black Forest. You get galop, galop, you know, and you get the hunting horns and so on. But at least this is at the other pole. And we could say if the first the view of art maintains that the important thing is the how, and that this work of art hangs together as a unity, that it has coherence, internal coherence in the midst of all that complexity, that this is what art is. And you can talk about good and bad art, but you talk about it in terms of its form. This other end of the spectrum, or this other pole, says that form is important, but the what is important too. And you can distinguish. That is, that art ought to be, at least if not true, it ought to be probable, you see. It ought to be faithful to what is, or at least what is possible. And you find this in the what. Now, my position here in saying that art has meaning is a kind of third position. I find the third position congenial in politics sometimes, very often, most often. And I think a third position is more defensible here. And I would call this that art is an iconic symbol. Art is an iconic symbol. What is a symbol? A symbol is something which is in itself a something, but it points to something else. You saw a symbol tonight, cemented or somehow fastened to the piano. What was it? Canadian flag, brand new flag. That's a symbol. The flag is a symbol. You can speak of a cross as a symbol. That is, it is something in itself. It's it has its own stuff. It has its own shape. It's describable. Has its own life, its own vitality. But it points to something, and it is this pointing that is really the most important thing about it. Now, what is meant by an iconic symbol? Maybe I'm misusing that term. What I have in mind is the kind of thing I remember in the Russian Orthodox Cathedral in Leningrad. I sneaked away from the hotel. They stayed with us all the time. I thought I had hidden myself as the one maverick among 40 Finns, and that they wouldn't pay any attention to me, but they stuck to me particularly. But I got up early. It happened to be May 1st, the big Labor Day. And I was just scouting around, and this big parade seemed to be forming. And I kept going and going, and I ended up way out at this Greek Orthodox Cathedral. And it was filled with people, standing up, all of them. Service was going on, singing and the chanting and all. But people seemed to be so discourteous. They were walking around, a lot of them. And finally I saw what they were doing. They're going over to the sides and kissing paintings, or putting their hand, reaching up and touching a painting or a piece of sculpture. And the paintings were, some of you have seen these, they were on canvas, but they were covered with silver plate. And so the Madonna would, the face would show through. There'd be an opening, you see. And a little opening here for the hands and for the head of the Christ child. Well, those pieces of silver, the silver plate, had been put on not to decorate the picture, but to protect it, you see, just from being touched. And some of them later on, and I mean, that goes way back, you see. Then later, some of them were covered with glass. That was another simple way. But they'd still touch it.
and kiss it. The idea that this icon had power in itself. That is, it wasn't simply a symbol, it didn't point to something, but that it was something in itself. And you had to have some contact with it. Well, that's what I mean by iconic symbol then. That a work of art is iconic in the sense that it has its aesthetic power, which is rooted in the way the thing is done. Aesthetic quality comes from the way something is done, not the what. It comes from the how. And the difference between aesthetic, high aesthetic quality, high artistic quality, and low has to do with execution. It has to do with the doing of this thing. It just as you take the same song, one person makes it memorable, you see. The other person makes you embarrassed. It's the same song. It's in the how. This is not easy to understand. That the artistic aesthetic power is in the how of the thing. But symbolic in the sense that it points. Well, that's my philosophy of art. And I had to say it because there's no sense in going on talking about a work of art and say it has meaning if art in general doesn't have any meaning. Now, does anybody want to make some comments on this? Does anybody want to leave? Because we're going to proceed on the presupposition that art has meaning. At least it may have meaning. And I would say that at least when it comes to art that uses words, then meaning is indispensable and inescapable because words in themselves have meaning before they're used artistically. Paint doesn't. Sound doesn't. But it seems to me in literature anyway that meaning is inescapable. It points to something else. What we'll be doing now with these books will be to take a partial approach. Let's say we're going to take the approach after the aesthetic fact. When you read a poem, when you read this, I would insist that substance and form are wedded together. But afterwards, one can ask the question. You can ask the question about form. You can ask the question about the substance, about the meaning. This is an analytic approach. Well, what can we do with this thing? We'll just start on this tonight. We'll pick this up again along with Brand, written, I think, by the same fellow. And, in a way, we really should take Brand first. At least it was written first, but before this one. But because of this theory of art, that art has meaning, I think the sequence of meaning says this ought to come first. But there is a relationship between this. Well, what does this thing mean? Who wants to? Who has read it? One, two, three. Well, maybe we shouldn't. Well, we can just make a little start. But I hope that some of you, more of you, will read it before we meet again. And have Brown read also. How many copies are around? Even the cover is significant in a way. This cover, the photograph, is a photograph of the man who played the part of Peer Gynt in the old Vic production of this translation just a few years ago. But doesn't his face say something? Don't you think of Dylan Thomas, maybe? Or Bean or somebody? I mean, he's a half pixie, isn't he? And
just don't know what's going to happen. I think his face says this sort of thing. Well, that's the way the play is. You don't really know what's going to happen. It starts out, here this young lad of 20 comes home, whose mother is, any mother should say, even to a wayward son, where have you been? He said, oh, I've been riding a buck from mountain to mountain. And she listens, you know, she's fascinated. Oh, you lie. You're just telling more of your lies. And then they talk a bit, and turns out that his old girlfriend is being married. And the big wedding party is that night. Oh, I think I'll go. Well, you haven't been invited. I don't have to. Peer Gynt doesn't have to be invited. Peer Gynt goes where he wants to go. So he goes and meets a little girl who's just been confirmed, has a nice little white apron on. Her name is Solveig. He does notice her, but he gets into various things, including, including kidnapping the bride. And he takes her off into the mountains. And they're together a couple days and nights, and then he ditches her and takes up with the setter girls. And this leads on into the hall of the mountain king, the trolls, and takes up with the troll princess. And he's going to be made a member. He's going to marry the troll princess and become the heir to the throne of the troll kingdom. But they have to, I'll pay attention here. When they go from one kingdom to another, they have to be naturalized, you see. And so they're going to induct him. And it involves various things. One, tying a troll tail to him. And he said, well, wait a minute. Can that troll tail be taken off later? Well, what are you talking about? Once a troll, always a troll, you see. And they go through various things. To be a troll means that black is white and sweet is sour and so on and so on. And he said, well, I don't mind all this. It sounds like fun. But I want to get out if I want to get out. I'm not going to take up some permanent citizenship here and get stuck with it. So it ends up with he's really backing out, and then they all attack him. Those of you who know Grieg's music perhaps remember best of all the Hall of the Mountain King. You know, boom, 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 boom. You know, it goes faster and faster. Well, that's all the little trolls gouging his eyes and pinching him and poking him, you see, because he isn't even a good troll, you see. So he goes out and he meets the boy. And what is the boy? Well, that's a lot of debate about what the boy is. At least the boy says one thing, go runt, go around, go around. And, well, that's actually what Peer Gynt's been doing, you see, is going around instead of going straight through to anything, as far as that goes. Then he does all kinds of things. It's a fantastic business. Some people say that the thing doesn't hang together, the formalists say. It doesn't hang together. You get crazy Act 4, for example. This affair with Anitra. He gets to be an emperor. How does he get to be an emperor? He happens to find some clothes and a white horse, you see. He gets to be an emperor, which he's dreamed of being from the very beginning. Oh, he lay above the hill, on the hill above the wedding farm for a while, dreaming about the emperor Peer Gynt, you know, on his white horse. Well, here he gets to be emperor by accident. You know, some people have stolen this stuff and have thrown it away, and So he gets, and of course, Anitra, he thinks is going to be the kind of the empress, but then she does him in and cheats him. Maybe you pay attention to that too. But this Act Four is the wildest thing. It's a fantastic thing. It's Peer Gynt and a German and a Frenchman. And it's an international group, cosmopolitan group. And they the most amazing discussion. And you have a setting in Egypt and with the Sphinx, and then also a... well, it ends in a madhouse. Let's see if I can find that. Somebody remember where that is? 112 in this edition. And Michael Meyer. Oh yes, and it you have this. They think they're different things. Back in 111, my story, Your Majesty, is briefly this. People think I'm blotting paper, but I'm not. I'm a pen. Peer Gynt says, my story, imperial pen, is equally brief. I'm a blank sheet of paper that no one will write on. Hussein says, nobody understands where my talent lies. They all want to use me to soak up ink. Peer says, I was a book with a silver clasp that a girl held in her hands. This actually is a reference back to Solveig with her little hymn book, you see, a little prayer book. Whether we're called mad or sane, it is merely a printer's error. Can you imagine a more frustrating life than to be a pen and never taste the edge of a knife? That is, this is a quill pen, you see. Peer jumps in the air. Imagine being a reindeer. You jump down from a height, falling and falling and never to feel the ground under your hoof. And Hussein says, a knife, I'm blunt. Come, cut me, slit me, the world will perish if somebody doesn't sharpen me. Peer, alas for the world which our Lord thought so good. And another fellow comes in, the Griffenfeld. Here is a knife. Hussein seizes it. Ah, how I shall lick up the ink. What a relief to cut oneself to a point. And he cuts his throat. The Griffenfeld says, don't splash on me. Peer, hold him, hold him. Hussein says, hold me, that's the word, hold me, hold the pen. Paper, put the paper on the desk. And he falls with his cutthroat. And I'm worn out, my postscript, don't forget it. He lived and he died, a pen guided by other hands. Peer becomes dizzy. What shall I, oh, what am I? Oh, great one, hold me safe. I am whatever you wish. I'm a Turk, a sinner, a troll. Only help me. Something has burst. I can't remember your name. Oh, help me thou, O guardian of all madmen. The Griffenfeld comes with a crown of straw and jumps on and jumps astride Peer. Ha, see him sitting enthroned in the mire. Beside himself, crown him now. So he crowns Peer Gynt with his crown of straw. Hail, Emperor of Self. And es lebe hoch der große Peer, the German says. Well, this fourth act, the formalists say, really doesn't belong here. It's so wild. It's just the crazy Norwegian has cooked this thing up to pad it out, you see. It isn't long enough. So he puts in all this jackanape stuff. Then we'll just come back to that in a moment. Then we have Act Five, which is obviously the cumulative act, pairs on a ship, talks with a stranger, the ship sinks, Peer pushes the cook off. That's gratitude, I mean. And saves himself, you see. Then he gets back to Norway and was on his way up Gudbrandsdal to the old home place. And he's not like the Italian. He does find an onion, but he doesn't start a restaurant. He peels the onion and reflects on the onion. The onion is an occasion for some thought. Then he's met by the button molder. He says to Pear, I've come to get you. Why do you want me? Well, I've come to melt you down, make buttons out of you. Pear says, well, why? I haven't done anything. Well, he said, that's just it. You really just haven't done anything. You've done a lot of things, but you really haven't done anything. Pear said, well, oh yes I have. I can get people to sign a paper for me, say that I've, you know, done this and been that. So he goes around trying to get people to sign an affidavit for him. and he can't get anybody to sign for him. You see, the Troll King won't sign for him. He said, you? He said, you're kind of half troll and half man, but you weren't really a troll and you weren't a man, and I won't sign for you. So that's the way it went. He couldn't get anybody who would really sign for him. He even found one fellow called a Tin Man who seemed to know most everything. In a very special way. No reason why he shouldn't. He had special feet, Pear noticed. They looked a little bit like cloven hoofs. But he wouldn't sign for him either, you see. So Pear couldn't get anybody to sign for him. Then finally, the thing ends with what you people know. More of you will know, even if you don't know this or know anything else, and that is Solveig's song. There's Solveig at the end of the trail, you see. The little girl with the white apron back there at the beginning. And she...
he had one other meeting with Solveig.
Oh, a number of meetings. Yes, that's right. Yes, and she had waited. You see. Right, right. There are a lot of things in the middle here. But she had waited. In fact, she had left her family, really, to come to him up in the mountains. A hut, you see, that was built. And this would be their place. But Pear ran out on her, you see, for various reasons. And at the end here, in 157, Pear says, then I am lost. Solveig speaks up. There is one who rules all. Lost unless you can solve riddles. Tell me. And Pear says, tell you? Yes, I will. Can you tell me where Pear Gynt has been since you saw him last? And Solveig says, been? And Pear answers, with the mark of destiny on his brow, as he sprang forth in the mind of God. Can you answer me that? If not, I must go to my home. Down to the land of the mist, that is, the button molder would pick him up. Tell me then, where was myself, my whole self, my true self, the self that bore God's stamp upon its brow? And Solveig answers, in my faith, in my hope, and in my love. Pear starts back, what? What do you say? Hush. Now you speak in riddles. Are you a mother to that child? Yes, I am, but who is its father? Yes, I am, but who is its father? It is he who forgives when the mother prays. My mother, my wife, O thou pure woman, O hide me in your love, hide me, and he clings tightly to her. And then Solveig sings. That's Solveig's song. And it ends, sleep, O sleep. Now, I've seen some versions of Peer Gynt which have ended right there with Solveig's song. because it, according to this formalist view, it's a good ending. You see, I mean, a lullaby is a fine way to end. It has unity, it gives unity. But the play doesn't end that way, the way Ibsen wrote it. There's a voice from behind the house, the button molder. "We shall meet at the last crossroads, pair. And then we'll see if..." Dash. I'll say no more. And Solvay says, "I will cradle you, I will guard you, O Canada. Sleep and dream." Well, now, I think we should close. I'd just like to suggest a number of understandings of this, and then ask you people to think about these, and then some more that maybe you don't agree with these that I'm going to suggest very quickly. You may not quite understand them if you haven't read the book, but one is a nationalist interpretation. That is that this takes a couple forms. This is a criticism of Norwegians, Norwegian nationalism itself. In the Hall of the Mountain King, for example, they what they drink is awful stuff, but it's made in Norway. You see, you know, it's just made in Canada, made in USA, tack, you see. Then there's also a discussion of language that anticipates what in Norway is now called Nynorsk, this attempt to purify the Norwegian language. And there's a burlesque of this in the book, which we didn't touch on. Another aspect of this, call it national interpretation, is that this is an anti-immigration tract. That here's the wayward son who doesn't make a go of it at home, and he thinks if he goes to North America, he had a big business in Charleston, South Carolina, for, you see, and then he was all over the world, really. He's in California too, by the way, panning gold. But then he comes home to Mother Norway, you see. Solveig is Mother Norway. And there, Mother Norway has been faithful, even though this son of Norway has been faithless, you see. It's a kind of a national version of the prodigal son. You see. But the immigrant is a deserter, just as, for example, in Germany. Those who founded the Missouri Synod came illegally. You know that? A bunch of criminals. Absolutely. There were anti-immigration acts. Kiel had one, and they sailed from Kiel, you see. Sure. And there are a lot of pressure against this America fever, you see. This immigration. Well, this is one interpretation. Another one is that this whole thing is really a drama about the conflict of egotism and altruism. That Peer Gynt is the exploiter, you see, the egocentric, the selfish. I mean, using everybody. His mother, when she tries to say something to her, he throws her up on the roof and walks off on her, you see. Steals the bride and ditches her, picks up with these setter girls and the troll princess and ditches them, you see. And look how he does business. Sends missionaries for 6 months and then sends amulets and magic stuff and shifts the missionaries. You know, turnover is a business called, businessmen call it. So all the way through, he's an exploiter. But Solveig is the one who loves the other and saves him, you see. So the only salvation for the egotist is to become an altruist, or at least to be saved by one who has love for the other. Another interpretation that has been given of this earnestly has been that this is really a critique of romanticism. Peer Gynt is the dreamer, you see, the romantic individualist who thinks there are no limits and can do everything, but finally comes to his own downfall because of this. Another interpretation, contemporary interpretation, Freudian interpretation, is that this is a drama of the eternal feminine. You see, it's the kind of thing that Shaw presents in some of his plays. What makes the world go round? It is the feminine. Why does the man propose to the girl? Because the girl has pursued him and made him propose. You didn't know that. You see. And the cleverness of the eternal feminine, die ewige Weibliche, is to make men think that they are pursuers, that they are masters, you see. And that the real secret is the feminine. I haven't addressed this to you. I figured you'd found this out by now. I mean, as long as if you can protect a man, even if it's a little too late, I figure one should do what he can. Or the last that I'll mention is that this is basically a philosophical dialogue between two views, two ethical views, which I can state very quickly. One, the Cyrenaic view, which maintains that the highest good is pleasure, and the best pleasure is pleasure now, not tomorrow, not yesterday, but now, right now. And the more intense pleasure is better than weak pleasure. And furthermore, that this is all done in total freedom, so that you can always leave off. Never get too close. Always have the windows open, the back door open. Always have a bridge behind you. Always never do anything with two hands. Always have one hand free, you see, and get the other hand free. The motto of the Cyrenaics is habeo non habior. I have, but I am not had. Use, but don't be used. Exploit, but don't get caught being exploited. That's a Cyrenaic view. The Epicurean view also holds that pleasure is the highest good, but there are different pleasures. That is, there are qualities of pleasure. In 19th century utilitarianism, we get the same distinction between Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. And the Benthamites took really the Cyrenaic view. John Stuart Mill said, better to be a Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. That there are different qualities of satisfaction and pleasure. Whereas the Benthamites said, pushpin is as good as poetry. That is, what do you call these pinball machines? That's as good as poetry. And Epicurus maintained the duration of pleasure. And that this is the argument here, and that Solvay represents duration, you see, continuity in pleasure. And Peer Gynt represents the momentary Cyrenaic view. Well, I just mention these have all been presented as interpretations. When we meet next time, we'll start with this. You may have a seventh interpretation of this, or an eighth.
One of the dominant themes here has been this role of woman in the art. And here you do have specifically the art of the play. I mean, the fight with the boy, the climax, the redemptive role of woman which young of the 20th century is scorned, laughs at, no bigger insult than to be called wholesome, and the thing you want to be is a vixen, a vampire, a destroyer. And the 20th century's been dominated by Strindberg, actually, and Munch, our Munch, who made woman out to be in his form, Munch in his art, Strindberg in his drama, set the tone of the 20th century. And I'll say after you got your choice, where the woman goes. But we noticed in movies last year how there was this foreign movie like Estrada or Ordis, who continued his line, woman is redemptive, and one American, one consecrator, all the rest women is either neuter or simply to be exploited or to destroy it. It's that concept of women is old-fashioned for our country.
But this view of, if one takes that, is that considers that the key to it, this would encompass conceivably both conceptions of women, you see.
Yeah.
In both cases, women would be the dominant, you see, whether they destroy or save. They're still that which makes the world go round.
But,
you
know, the thing that's so big in purity and representing Norway, of course, is appealing to the son of Norway, and especially one of Gudbrand's dog. But knowing how the author feels, you know, about Norway, I'm surprised that this would be pretended to be his doctor, suggestion. He left Norway mad at him.
Well, that's why I said there are two aspects here of this national approach. One, this anti-immigration thing, and the other, a critique. And a lot of Norwegians took it that way at the time. Oh, they're angry, extremely angry. And this whole thing was an attack.
Howard, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What does the fact of these differing interpretations, what relationship does that have to the meaning of the language?
Well, I'd say they're different, but the play apparently is capable of generating different interpretations. That is, the meaning of the play is complex enough to generate different interpretations. And making these interpretations, there's an appeal to certain criteria, implicitly. One, that the substance of the play supports this interpretation or that interpretation. I mean, that one isn't doing this arbitrarily, that one can go to the play and support this. The second criterion, that the interpretation hangs together. It has some coherence to it. Now, any of you who come with a seventh interpretation will actually be using a third criterion, I suspect, and that'll be the criterion of adequacy. You may say that some parts of the play can support this interpretation or that interpretation, and interpretation can hang together, but that it isn't adequate because it doesn't take the whole play into consideration, that it's there's something selective about it.
Well, but wherein does the meaning lie? In the play itself or in the different interpretation of the
interpretation? Well, no, I think it lies in the play. Certainly. And the interpretation is a secondary formulation, an attempt to address the question of what does this mean, what's the man saying, and simply to formulate it after, you could say, after the play, after you've read the play, after the aesthetic fact.